Nighttime on Still Waters. This is NB506812, narrowcasting into the night from somewhere on Britain's waterways.
March 17th, Friday. The sun is warm. To the west, the clouds are Prussian blue, like mountains of the imagination. A woodpecker laughs from somewhere across the fields which fill with lambs, and the sound of young calling to old. A branch hangs, whose scars are unhidden. This is the Narrowboat Erica, narrowcasting into a mad March night, to you, wherever you are. It's calm now after a wild and windy week, but the clouds are still heavy and thick, and there is no moon or stars. I'm so pleased that you came. I was really hoping you'd be here. So come inside. The cabin is cozy and the kettle is on. Make yourself comfortable. And welcome aboard. It's been another of those weeks in which we seem to have had all the seasons rolled into one. And I was reading earlier that treasure trove that is Miles Hadfield's An English Almanac. And in it he quotes one unnamed scientist who describes March as comprising a hasty panorama of all seasons. And that's certainly been the case this week. On Wednesday, I couldn't get into my car because the doors were so solidly frozen. And yet today, outside, it's been t-shirt weather. I suppose the last few days can be best characterized as wet and windy. And the wind has been backing and veering so frequently and rapidly that I'm sure the poor weathercock spinning away on the village church steeple must be quite dizzy. And the wind itself on some days is playful and mild, while on others it's savage and raw. And the barometer has rarely been so busy, sweeping the dial clockwise and anti-clockwise. It's all to do with the sudden stratospheric warming that has occurred a couple of weeks ago. This creates the conditions for very stable high-pressure systems. And the problem is that there are a lot of Atlantic-driven lows that are constantly battling against that high. And we're sitting right under that battle of warm and cold fronts. Alexandra Harris, in her fascinating book Weatherland, observes that equating the different air systems with warfare actually served as the inspiration for those terms used within meteorology. She notes that in the early 20th century, meteorologists from the Bergen School in Norway proposed the movement of air masses by analogy with the advance and retreat of battle lines in the First World War. And warm and cold fronts took their name from the front lines of the trenches. And though I'm a little critical of this tendency to always frame everything in terms of conflict and aggression, these last few weeks I think the terminology of clashing fronts is an apt one. March, as Miles Hadfield again points out, is, after all, named after Martius, or Mars, the god of war. And before that, the Anglo-Saxons called it Chludmonath, the loud month. Hannah Vidin notes that March continued to be called Lida, a variant of Cluda, as recently as the 17th century, and that, according to the Menologium, March arrives adorned with rime, passing through Middle-earth with hail showers. It's both Retha, fierce, and Helic proud. And with the blustering of the wind rushing and beating around the boat, and the drum and wash of rain on the cabin roof and sides, it certainly lived up to its older name, Loud Month. And there has certainly been something rather heroic about its Refa and Helic qualities. And Ruth Binney mentions a further name used in Anglo-Saxon literature relating to the month of March, and that is Lincton Monath, the month of spring. Well, actually, Lincton is to lengthen. Lincton Monath, the month of the lengthening. It's where our term Lent owes its origin. A period that occurs during the time of the year when the days are lengthening with light, and associated within the Christian calendar with not just the lead into Easter, but the conception of the Christ child, the incarnation of God. Again, these themes of light coming into darkness run through Christian and pre-Christian thought. And the days are certainly lengthening. We have gained just a few minutes under half an hour of light just this past week. And with that, more of the hedgerows are bursting with blossom. The early whites of cherry and damson are now beginning to flow into blackthorn. Although most of the blossom around the boat at least is still tightly furred in tiny green globes, it'll only take a week or two before the towpaths will be transformed into drifts of snow blossom. And even now, on the edge of perception, a haze of green, thin and mist-like, is colouring the browns of winter. And the willow, always one of the first to leaf, are getting quite green, and others are clothed in just a gossamer hint of green. But winter's back is broken. There's a feeling that I sometimes get when I sit down on a bank of grass. One of those strange, almost indefinable feelings that I'm not sure if it is sensory or purely mental. Although it's more the former, I think. And I had it just now. It was the first time this year. A sudden, vertiginous, somatic rush. A giddying whirl of the senses. A disorientation that's neither violent nor disturbing, but welcoming, even comforting. That always takes me back to those places I've never really been, that exist somewhere but not here. Not in the flicker book moments of my past, although it links me to fleeting memories. Vague, as ephemeral as the ring spreading outward on water from a skipped stone. The canal glints in the warm sunshine. Sparks of light glancing from the water's surface. And there's that feeling again. I'm here but not here. I'm lost in a world that makes little sense, and yet here I feel home. Or at least I'm reminded of home, that there is a home. A home that smells of damp grass and rustles with dead reeds, that smells hay sweet and is warm as the horse's breath. The unsilent quietness filled with the myriad movements of life. Or perhaps it just reminds me of all the other half-remembered times that I've sat back among the tall grasses. and the warmth today in this sheltered spot is sleepy and hypnotic. I know I should move on soon. There are jobs waiting for me to do. This is grabbed time. But it's so hard. Hard to resist that beguiling lassitude of sunshine on my shoulders and the gentle stirrings of wind. Although a little further up the hill, the wind is anything but gentle. It rushes the treetops with exuberant hurrahs. In fact, I could easily forget that I'm sitting by a small reed bed in a boggy, waterlogged edge of a field in mid-March. The ground glistens and squelches each time I move my feet. But it could be summer's past, sweet with the sharp tang of crushed grass and damp soil, of lying among the tall grasses, under blue skies, cut feathery with contrails and the slicing sweep of swallows, when time seemed to stand still, and I could lose myself in just that tiny little patch of earth inches from my nose, and be constantly amazed by the wealth of life that that small area contained. I can hear the tapping of a woodpecker in the copse of trees on the other side of the canal, and the sound of lambs, and always, always the stabbing curt monosyllables of the jackdaw and the rattling laughter of magpies. Whatever this feeling is, it's as if a major part of my mind falls silent, shuts down. Something closes down. It's all still there, but I cannot reach it. And for a while at least, I am grateful of that. And all I am left with is, right now, this moment, on the bankside of a canal that glitters in the sunshine, just me, aware of my physical presence here, incapable of thinking of anything else but being. It was so lovely to hear from Andrea Hansen this week, and thank you. I'm really pleased that you enjoyed that episode about my old walking boots. It certainly has struck so many chords with different people. And gosh, your hiking in Colorado sounds absolutely amazing. What an incredible experience to see 20,000 sandhill cranes. That must have been a memory to treasure forever. And hello also to Jason Polite and Laurie and Bodie and Sue Bread Lady. And hello also to Margaret and Tony for leaving voicemails. It's always great to hear both your voices, and thank you. And a special thank you and shout out to all of our Lockwheelers, and thank you for supporting this podcast. They are Mary Keane, Arabella Hotsapful, Rory and MJ, Narrowboat Precious Jet, Linda Reynolds Birkins, Richard Noble, Carol Ferguson. And a special welcome and thank you to our new Lockwheelers, Tracy Thomas, Madeline Smith, and Mike and Tricia Stowe. And hi, Mike and Tricia. Mike and Tricia have been listening to this podcast and supporting it unstintingly, almost from the very first few episodes, and I always really appreciate all that you do. So thank you so much, Mike and Trish. I am the sea blast. I am the tidal wave. I am the thunderous surf. I am the stag of the seven tines. I am the cliff hawk. I am the sunlit dewdrop. I am the fairest of flowers. I am the rampaging boar. I am the swift-swimming salmon. I am the placid lake. I am the summit of art. I am the veil of echoing voices. I am the battle-hardened spearhead. I am the god who inflames desire, who gives you fire. Who spreads light in the gathering on the hills? Who can tell the ages of the moon? Who can tell the place where the sun rests? The Song of Amagin. Powerfully resonant words, and possibly one of the oldest surviving poems from the British Isles. Composed, or at least attributed, to the Irish poet-bard Amagin. And it still has power to touch deeply. It does what good poetry does. It helps us to see. It helps us to understand and make sense of us and our lived worlds. And it comes from a time when poets and the bardic system were located at the heart of governance, operating as trickster and foil, speaking truth to power, and calling remembrance to older wisdoms and knowledge. And I wish they were here still. It's that time of year when I'm asked to be one of the judges for the poetry competition where I work. And it's open to all our students and staff. And it's a task that I dread and look forward to in equal measure. It's one I feel hopelessly unqualified to do. I'm not a poet, certainly do not see myself as one, or even see myself as a writer. I love words, their power, their magic, but that's all. I couldn't identify a good poem if one hit me in the face. I often come across poems or pieces of writing that might strike a chord with me, and I may even share them here with you. But I can give no consideration or judgment about whether, as poems or pieces of writing, they are good or not. And, more importantly, why. And I know this all sounds like a classic case of imposter syndrome. However, there is one major difference. It's real. I am, and I am fully aware of it, an imposter. I shouldn't be there. I am the taxi driver who finds himself being interviewed on Newsnight about some weighty governmental policy because my name has been confused with the expert that they have actually booked. It's a role that I sort of fell into, and subsequently have found huge difficulty in attempting to disentangle myself from. It's not that generally I have difficulty with saying no, although that's true, I do. It's just that I'm not totally convinced that I want to say no. Poetry, writing it as well as reading it, can be powerful. And we need poets in this world more than ever. People trained to think deeply and think creatively, to express the inexpressible things that can tame the wild and empower the tamed. To look deeply within, as well as to look deeply at the big and large questions that we face. And I want to be part of something that encourages that growth, that creates the opportunity for someone to pick up a pen or open their laptop and to begin to write from somewhere deep inside of them. Okay, so some are a bit rough and awkward, wrestling with rhymes and the tyranny of scansion, but that's to be expected. The blackbird's song takes many seasons to mature into the liquid river of song that we admire. Many of these are young voices yet to find themselves. Blackbirds learning to sing. And the main thing, the most important thing, is that they are given a chance to lift their voices into the sky and for them to hear themselves sing. And that is a scary and frightening thing. I know that fear all too well. Every time I press publish on this podcast, that sense of vulnerability. And so I want to encourage them in that. Reading through this year's entries, I've been surprised by how many articulate such a sense of loneliness, of alienation and disconnection. I'm sure these are the themes well explored in the stereotypical tropes of the adolescent poet, and most of the poems try to end on a positive note, but often that note is rather dull and unconvincing. For the entries from last year and the ones before, mental health was an often repeated theme, and that was to be expected. The shadow of the pandemic and its after effects still loomed large. But in a world of the digitally connected, a sense of isolation and loneliness seems to be almost endemic. And I'm uneasy about judging these poems. They're so raw, so intensely confessional and personal. They come from some deep private place within the writer. And I'd certainly be really worried if some of these were chosen to be winners where the writer then has to read them out to the public. And I'm even at times a little uncomfortable about reading them myself. But then again, that is exactly what poetry should do. Disarm us. The readers. Make us think. Take our breath away. Open our eyes to something hidden. Writing poetry tends to always first take us to the deepest parts of ourselves, reflective to the point of discomfort, articulating those hidden feelings we normally leave unexplored. It's how we learn to find ways to express what is ultimately inexpressible. The ineffable aspects of our lives. Shadow boxing our demons until we can lay them low by a neat phrase or win them over as our allies. And it's then that the work of the poet begins. Looking outward. Seeing the world with different eyes. Helping us, the reader and hearers, to make connections that were once lost. We see with new eyes, and we see through the eyes of others. The poet makes shamans out of us all. I am the cliff hawk. I am the sunlit dewdrop. I am the fairest of flowers. I am the rampaging boar. I am the swift-swimming salmon. And there are echoes of the Song of Amagon in the words of another ancient poet, Taliesin, the 6th century bard from the Old North, who then becomes associated with the Welsh bardic tradition. And Taliesin, like Amagon, helps us to inhabit the skins of others, to see the world through different eyes. In one of his poems, he tells the story of a grain that's made into beer. Part alchemic, part shamanic, part educational, part entertainment. And it is this quality within his writings that has caused some to view Taliesin with a shape-shifting or composing within the orbits of shamanism. And I don't know enough about the subject or the literature, but I do know that his words ring a bell that resonates deeply within me. A call to recognize the connectedness of everything, animate and inanimate. In that sense, Taliesin's words are inherently ecological. Listen to this extract from his poem, An Unfriendly Crowd. And I was a blue salmon, a hound and a stag, a roebuck on the mountain, a clod and a spade, and an axe in the hand, an auger gripped in tongs for a year and a half, a speckled white cockerel for the hens of Aydin, a stallion at stud, a ramping bull, a sheaf stack for milling, meal ground for farmers. I was a grain in the sieve, grain that grew on the hill. Perhaps this is why I find these poems much more powerful than those of the classical English tradition. As beautiful as I'm told Cædmon's hymn is, often framed as the birth of English poetry, it does not touch me as deeply and as powerfully as the words of Amagin and Taliesin and the others from the bardic tradition. At the turn of this century, a group of environmental and climate scientists met together with those within the creative sectors asking for their help. How can you speak to a people, a culture, about issues we face when they do not respond to reason or evidence? They asked. We have said it all. We have run out of arguments. We have run out of proofs. We have run out of evidence. They may not listen to us. They may listen to you. Amagin and Taliesin's voices are once more being listened to. We also need to hear others. Perhaps the voices that I am beginning to hear when I read these faltering songs of the blackbirds in their youth. Those like this little group, through whose tentative forays into poetry I am going through. Those who are finding the courage to lift up their voice and be heard, no matter how vulnerable and exposed it makes them. Perhaps you too, finding ways to recreate those old lost connections, to see the world in the ways which we need to see it, to help us to see through the others' eyes, to help us create I-thou relationships from those we have always viewed as I-it. I know all the levels between heaven and earth. Why the hollow echoes, why death comes suddenly, why silver glitters and the brook runs dark, why breath is black and the liver's full of blood, why the buck has horns, why a woman's hot with lust, why milk is white and holly green, why the young goat's always bearded, why cow parsley's hollow-stemmed, why the puppy staggers like a drunk, why the mallet strikes flat, why roebuck is dappled, why salt is salty and beer is bitter, why the alders streak blood red, and the linnet is green, and the rose hips are crimson, and the women who gather them, when the night falls, from what changes are shaped in the golden sea. But no one knows why the sun's breast blushes, the colour so dazzling, nor the fall of the famous, what the harp strings mourns for, what the cuckoo's song laments, how its sound is sustained, makes jewels from the hardness of stones, why meadowsweet smells fragrant, why the raven's wing shimmers. The cuckoos of summer, I know them in winter. The owen of my song I draw up from the depths, the world-circling river. I know its great power. I know how it ebbs. I know how it flows. I know how it runs on and how it falls back. I know all the life that lives under the sea. I know the true nature of each in its kind, how many instants a day has, how many days in the year, how many shafts fall in battle, and the drops fall in rain. I know why the sea rages drunkenly, why fishes are black, their flesh fed by sea life, why the stag is wise, why the fish is scaly, why white swans have black feet. This is the Narrowboat Erica, signing off for the night and wishing you a very warm, restful, peaceful night. Good night. Temperature outside, 10.2 degrees. Inside, 24 degrees. Humidity, 90%. Dew point, 8 degrees. Wind direction, south. Wind strength, 8 miles per hour. Barometric pressure, 1003.1, rising. Cloud cover, 95%. Cloud ceiling, 6,100 feet. Precipitation, 0.51 millimeters. Moon phase, 19%. Waning crescent. Day length, 11 hours, 57 minutes. Sunset, 18:14. Sky casting, 6:15.